ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello and welcome to the Belief Series. There's been a few media types, journalists, a cartoonist on the series so far, and really that's just a reflection of me and my interests. In this, the first series, I'm going to look at those I know and those who are close at hand, but I also think that many of these writers and observers have a profound influence on how the rest of us think. We read them day in and day out, and they shape us quite deeply. Janet Albrechtson is a columnist with the Australian newspaper. She's been writing columns and reporting there for over 20 years. She was originally a lawyer, worked as a commercial solicitor before journalism got in the way, as she says. Her beliefs are apparent in her writing. She's strong in her opinions. She'll argue a point forcibly, and that might be a point of law, an area of social controversy, a political debate of the day. She's been a board member of the ABC, a director of the Institute for Public Affairs, and even a chair of committees at the National Museum of Australia. I wanted to talk to her because I wondered whether she had principles articulated, beliefs that she could state, and was that from where her writing would spring? Or were her beliefs more malleable than that, and was she really more of a contrarian? If this is a common view, then what happens when you react against it? Now that we are some way into the series, some guests have heard previous episodes. This is us chatting before we began officially.
The George Miller one was great,
yeah,
and the historian from Melbourne.
Claire Wright.
She was fabulous.
Yeah, yeah.
So if you haven't heard those earlier episodes, try them. Try them all. You might like them. We picked up further on the beliefs of George Miller and his enchantment with the architect and general seer, Buckminster Fuller.
Well, I really enjoyed the George Miller idea, and I know it wasn't his original idea, but it has formed very much part of who he is.
He said, I am not a noun, I seem to be a verb. It changed the way I approach life.
And I'd never really thought about describing myself as a verb as opposed to a noun, but I definitely want to be a verb.
Yeah, wasn't that great?
I don't want to be a noun.
I was so struck by that. I thought, it's so simple, but I'm Jamesing all the time.
Janeting. I don't know that that works.
I thought I'd jump right in with why I came. Did she have solid beliefs, beliefs that she was aware of?
I don't sit down and spend a lot of time thinking about what I believe in. Maybe I should. Maybe I do. You know, maybe in terms of when I'm writing, I am doing that. I don't sit in a chair and go, right, what is it that I believe in? But when I'm thinking about an issue, obviously I do it through a prism of, well, what is it about that issue that interests me, that I find troubling, that I would like to challenge or I'd like to support, that I'd like to explain to readers? So in that way, I think I'm often, yes, I guess it's my business, isn't it, to set down on paper what I believe.
Hmm.
I can be an expert on anything any week that you like. You know, if I think about the one thing that I believe in, it really is the power of words, of ideas, confronting issues through words and arguments, and not becoming complacent about any particular thing that that we're doing, the way we're doing things. I don't believe we should ever assume that we've reached the best way of doing anything, and therefore you have to constantly be challenging what you're doing in a rigorous way. I think you want to be looking for evidence, but you can't always find evidence for everything.
Mm.
I think there's a sense of intuitive, do you believe that women should have the vote? I mean, there wasn't evidence that women having the vote would be a good thing. You couldn't sort of go back and say, right, well, they're doing it in that country, and therefore, you know, the first people who introduced the vote didn't have anything to look back on. So whilst I would describe myself as someone who does like to hark back to the past to work out where we're going in the future, I don't think you can be that constrained where you have to have evidence for every single thing.
So even though one of Janet's first comments was to say she didn't have a strong set of beliefs, they were certainly starting to emerge. And talking about books brought them out even more.
I took a break last week. I took a couple of books with me. One was Atonement, which I read many years ago, but I reread it for some reason. I just picked it up and put it in my suitcase. And the other book I started reading was a new translation of Herodotus by Tom Holland. And rereading Atonement now, It just struck me that it sort of brought together so many of the issues that I really feel quite strongly about. And it's a great love story.
Mm.
It's a fabulous exploration of what are the consequences of betrayal, lying, It's a grand sweep of World War II. And then, of course, there's the atonement by the betrayer. But in the midst of this grand sweeping book is this small little story of when all the soldiers are in Dunkirk waiting to be evacuated back to Britain, you know, hundreds of thousands of soldiers, frustrated, worn out, exhausted, and they're in this blown-out pub with no beer, basically. And they target this small, bespectacled man who works in the RAF, and they start circling around him, and he just becomes a target of all their anxiety and their frustration and their exhaustion. And as the group forms and the circle of people swells, there's one bloke in the book who says that as that circle swelled with people, any sense of individual responsibility just fell away. And it was that kind of group, that group think. Ian McEwan writes beautifully about how no one wanted to make a false note. It was just in keeping with that group. And it's just such a beautiful little scene, but it described to me very much of, I think what I believe in is I don't really like being a member of a group. I prefer to be, you know, outside a group and a bit contrarian. And it's lucky I'm not a musician like you, James, because I think I hit probably lots of false notes, lots of jarring notes.
Musicians are often pretty reluctant groups. What, and where do you see that playing out? Like, are you saying that as a group, as a community, the thing you most want to respect all the time is an individual's right to choose that sort of thing, to you to be able to live your life? Is that what?
Yeah, but also, you know, it's much easier being outside a group, being able to challenge ideas, as opposed to once you join a group, there's that sense of, and I get it, sort of, you know, tribal loyalty, whether it's a political party or any other group, that you don't want to make a jarring note. You don't want to say something that challenges. And I guess I've been privileged enough in the job that I have to be able to do that. I'm not a member of, you know, a political party. I've never thought of joining a political party. I wouldn't now because I describe myself very much as a political orphan. I think that helps me have the freedom to be able to write what I do.
Do you think everybody can do that?
No, I don't think so. No, I think, you know, each to their own. I think there's a lot to be said for groups, and I understand that there is a sense of belonging that comes from a group. And of course, you know, I get that sense of belonging from my family, from my friends, and people get it from different places. People will get it from a church. People will get it from a political party, all kinds of groups, lobby groups, yoga classes. People will get it from lots of different places, but I choose to get it at the very grassroots level of family and friends.
You said you believe in the power of words and ideas. Where have you seen that play out? What's a moment when you felt like, look at that, that's the power of ideas at work, that's the power of words?
Oh, gosh, in a million different ways. But, I mean, the Berlin Wall didn't fall down because soldiers brought it down. It came down because of a set of ideas. And it's the power of those words that form ideas that people understand and that they can then share with others and challenge. I mean, we don't know what bad ideas are until we challenge them and find out that they're bad. But it's the power of ideas. And you think of the, you know, the liberal project itself, it's not some, you know, cemented law of physics. It's just a series of ideas. And without the words to express those ideas, it's nothing. And without the words to keep defending those ideas, the liberal project will just fall away.
To explain the liberal project, what do you mean by that?
Oh, freedom, equality, all of the things that I think a modern democracy should aspire to and defend whenever it needs defending. And I think that's often because I think we sometimes forget the importance of the dignity that comes from treating every person equal regardless of their sex or their creed or their race and the freedom that flows from treating people in that way. So they're just a set of ideas. There's nothing special about them, but they do warrant defending.
Liberal is a strange word full of different, somewhat contradictory meanings, or maybe it's more understood in different ways. Liberal, here in Australia, will make people think of the Liberal Party, which is now thought of as a conservative party. Liberal in the US is thought to mean the Democrats or the liberal woke elites who are too liberal in what they allow. Liberal, in the sense Janet is using it, is describing a classical liberalism. The values of freedom and equality, the values of the Enlightenment, the French and US Revolution, but which we often hear now from the US again as meaning the freedom to own guns or the freedom to be free of government. Luckily, Janet went on to explain further.
I actually don't mean it in any of those senses.
Right.
Because I'm not even sure the Liberal Party's that liberal anymore.
Yeah.
I mean it in the true, like the smallest L that you can possibly think of, which is not associated with political parties, because I think a lot of political parties have lost sight of those values. I've always tried to have a set of first principles. So, you know, if I'm looking at an issue, it's like, well, what is the principle that guides you there? And, yeah, they tend to be those core principles around what I believe is the Liberal project. And, you know, I did a law degree. I was a lawyer for some years. So those legal principles matter a lot to me. And I think increasingly we're getting a bit blasé about whether the presumption of innocence, for example, is that important, or, you know, what does a fair trial look like? Those kinds of things have engaged me a lot in recent times, and they're just, again, they're just ideas.
And so not only some core beliefs, but first principles, the rule of law and so forth, strong foundations for her writings.
I love the law. I have a great deal of respect for the law, but I have a deep frustration about it too. You know, I was walking yesterday morning, and every year for 2 weeks, a little beach forms, and it's not usually there, but because of the tides and for some reason it's 2 weeks a year around, you know, August, September, this little beach forms, and all the locals take their little dogs down there, and it's beautiful. It's not a beach. No one actually goes there to swim.
It's a temporary magic land like the magic faraway tree.
It's literally like that, and it's just there for 2 weeks. But when it is there, people take their dogs down. And there's a big sign there now that says no dogs allowed that the local council's put up, and I think, you know, this is where the laws really drive me nuts.
More on dogs later. Much of her writing is about ensuring that the clash of words and ideas is alive and well. This means she's a free speech advocate. But is she a free speech absolutist?
No, I'm not an absolutist. No, I believe that we should have laws against defamation. I believe that we should have laws against the incitement to violence. I do worry that we have weaponized some words to close down free speech. And some years ago, it was all about being offended. And if you were offended in a certain way, then you had some inherent right to stop other people saying something that offended you. And, you know, that's based on how a person feels. It's very subjective. One person may be offended, another person may not. And sometimes we do need to be offended. You know, I think the great comedy offends people. Some ideas offend people deeply, but we have to be able to have those debates, whether it's around religion, whether it's around anything. And yes, there will be people who are offended. And I think increasingly now the new way of shutting down speech is that you're not allowed to harm someone's mental health. You know, as someone who has seen the problems with mental health, of course we should be cognizant of a person's mental health. But I think we also need to be careful not to allow people to use labels to close down free speech.
Mm. How do you balance that, though, if we're thinking of the offence times or the, you know, might be a mental health time now? The hurt is genuine. You know, the use of racial slurs causes genuine hurt and pain in people.
Yeah.
How do you balance that?
Look, I think it comes back to what is a civil society, and you encourage people to be civil. If you have laws and you're going to penalise everyone who offends someone else, I think you have a snowballing effect of people claiming to be hurt. Yes, some people will be hurt. As I said, if you start penalising people using the law as a weapon to shut down that speech that does hurt someone, I don't know how you control that. I guess that's my concern. How do you control that?
Mm-hmm.
And who decides?
Where does it stop? Where does it
and
stop?
Who decides?
And who decides?
So I think the upside of allowing free speech outweighs the downside that, yes, there will be hurt. And we can recognise that, and we can, you know, we ought to be a civil society. We shouldn't be going around slurring people. But often one person's slur is another person's challenging remark.
I suggested that there is often an imbalance of power and opportunity to consider. The insulted and offended are often a minority or not able to respond.
There is no society on earth that is equal in every respect. I think if we got there, it would be a pretty scary place, because you would have to impose a whole lot of rules and regulations on people to get any kind of imposed equality. Yeah. Every society has its power imbalances, and we can work against them.
If it's not law or imposition, what is it?
You know, you said it's a civil society. How do we create a civil society?
We create good kids, James. You know, like I see as one of my biggest achievements is raising three decent children. And I think if we can empower parents to do that, there are whole communities where that's not happening. And I think the biggest thing a society can possibly do is to bring up the next generation to be decent, to be educated.
Yeah, well, that's what I was going
to
say.
I come back to, you know, why it is that I believe that words are so important. There were two early issues that I started writing about, 20 years ago when I started writing. One was about the law and the other one was about literacy. Because 20 years ago I had my first child and she was very young and she wanted to read. Now, I had not been taught, you know, I went to a public school in Adelaide. I can't even remember how I learned to read, but, you know, like smart kids learn to read, but not every kid is smart. Mm. They need a bit more, you know, building blocks around them, structure. And so I was grappling with how to teach my young kid to read. And I just happened across phonics and I just had a look at it. And it struck me as intuitively correct that you would allow kids to break down the sounds of a word in order to build back.
What do you believe about parenting?
I mean, when I say that there was a bit of discipline in our house, there was a tiny bit. I'm pretty laissez-faire, I must say. You know, like if my kids came to me and wanted me to, you know, do their homework for them, the answer was always no. You go do the first draft and maybe I'll have a look at it. I didn't always know what was going on in my house, as I've discovered now. You discover later in life that, you know, the kids were actually running amok and you didn't always know about it, but they seem okay, so I'm all right with that. They were watching OC when they shouldn't have been and, you know, on The Sims, you know, when they were only, apparently, you know, my daughters tell me I only allowed them half an hour a night. I don't believe that because I wouldn't have been bothered checking, you know. Like if you're going to have a rule, you have to enforce it. And I don't think I ever enforced any of those rules, so I don't believe it was a rule, but anyway.
There's an area I'm interested in, and it's probably a focus of psychological research. It'll be called something like neuronostalgic temporal distortion studies. In other words, when we look back, do we see things with rose-coloured glasses, and does that often make it seem like things are getting worse today? Or are things getting worse? Does Janet think they're getting worse?
I do. Yeah, I do. And I don't want to be an old fogey saying that. But let me give you an example. I mentioned a moment ago that I very much describe myself as a political orphan. I wouldn't know who to vote for anymore, you know. But I remember years ago, I would love going to the... I loved Election Day. You know, I'd love the whole thing about it, right? Because there were great leaders that I would... And, you know, I have voted for a Labor leader. I voted for a Liberal leader. But there were leaders that I truly believed were good for the country. And I would have a spring in my step come election day. And my kids and I, we often talk about this. What is the spring in their step come election day? What has ever provided that spring in their step? Literally nothing, no one. There's been no leader in their lifetime that has encouraged them to get out and vote. Mm. And I think that's really sad. Yeah, I think that's a big marker of how things are worse. And why is it the case that good leaders have to be the exception rather than the rule? I believe that politics is worse. I think it's more dismal. Therefore, fewer people, good people, want to go into it.
What's worse?
I think the media has probably made it harder. There's a lot of, you know, everything's a gotcha moment. It's very hard to focus on what's going to happen in 6 months, let alone in a year. So it's just this everyday relentless cycle of how do we avoid a shit show every day? That's the focus.
Has the media ruined politics?
I suspect it's made it harder. If you talk to any politician, they will say social media. But my answer to them is always, well, get off social media. Just get off. Why don't you just do your job? Get off social media. Don't follow it. I do worry about social media and young kids. Mm. I think that vortex and the images of what girls should look like, what boys should be doing, all of that I find disturbing. I remember years ago listening to a podcast, you know, of all the geniuses out of Silicon Valley. None of their little kids had phones. Mm. None of them.
Yeah.
They were not going to allow their kids to have phones, yeah, or you know, unregulated internet access, because
yeah,
they knew it. You know, don't tell me that those geniuses didn't know what they were doing. They absolutely knew what they were unleashing.
Yeah. I have a combination of belief there. I believe they knew what they were doing, but I also don't quite believe they knew what they were unleashing. I don't get a sense that Mark Zuckerberg
quite understood what Facebook was until after the 2016 election. And then he went, oh, I didn't know I could do that.
You're probably right.
So a little bit of a sense to that. Do you believe the same thing about business? I mean, we've been through Qantas and the PwC and a Royal Commission into banks. Is business kind of worse than it used to be?
Maybe we just know more again because of the media. I don't know if it's worse. I do think we know more, and I think it's a good thing that we know what's going on within business. I think public pressure, you know, is a good thing. I think pylons can get a bit wild, but that's, you know, that's life. If you're going to be looking after hundreds of millions of dollars of other people's money, you're going to expect that the blowtorch is going to be applied to you, and if you're going to get very well be very well paid, then you have to accept that.
Mm. And I think often the pylon happens when it's well deserved.
Always go overboard too. Yeah. We always go overboard.
All this talk, and we're yet to discuss modern media. Janet is still writing a newspaper column, and I make a radio show for a news talk station. We're in what is often called legacy or heritage media. What does she make of the modern media world?
I love the diversity of the media now. I mean, you talk about legacy media, but I do believe that there are so many places to go now to read the news and to read commentary and to get a whole range of views. And we're fortunate about that. I like it when my readers will write to me and say, you know, I've never agreed with you until now. It's like, yay, just yay.
Yay. You won't agree with me next week.
Next week you'll hate me again, but that's okay. I always used to joke that every week I made a new set of friends and a new set of enemies, but that's a lot of writing opinion.
Yeah. You're the only person in answer to that question who said, oh, I think there's a lot of diversity. People usually answer with the, oh, we're all locked in our bubbles.
Yeah, but it's both, isn't it? It's whether you want to get sucked into that bubble. I mean, we're all adults. If you want to get sucked into a bubble, you can get sucked into a bubble. If you don't want to, you don't have to. I think it's good to read material that you don't agree with.
And I think it's actually easier to find that diversity than it used to be.
It is.
The internet allows you to find anything.
You can go down any rabbit hole you want if you're interested in enough, or you can go down a rabbit hole and stay there. Hmm. Now, that's your decision as an adult. So if you're getting sucked into some social media bubble or information bubble or fake news in one particular area, that's your problem.
And I tend not to believe that the past was actually that much different. If you read one kind of newspaper and you went to the one church and you worked in the one kind of job, you were in a bubble.
Exactly, yeah. I think we have many more bubbles that you can choose from, or you can dip in and out. That's how I see it.
Yeah.
But I do believe that we, you know, if I come back to politics again, you think of the television shows that were, you know, made. We've started rewatching West Wing. You couldn't make West Wing today. It's way too inspirational. It's way too nice. It's got really lovely people in the West Wing, let alone in the Oval Office. Mm-hmm. Now you have, what do you have, Succession, you have Game of Thrones, not Game of Thrones so
well,
much.
Sort of. I can put Succession, Game of Thrones, and I know what you mean.
It's the dark, it's the cynical, it's White Lotus, it's House of Cards. There's nothing really nice about modern political TV shows these days.
Yeah.
There's certainly nothing inspirational. I mean, I look at, you know, the dialogue in Succession. Those characters can barely string a sentence together. And if the C word's not used at least three times, you know, in each snippet, it's diabolical. So you've got to go back to sort of Aaron Sorkin in the 90s to get some really good dialogue going.
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? And not only can they string a sentence together, they can do it very quickly and walk at the same time.
I know, they can.
It's very impressive. Yeah.
It's as if it's been written down on paper somewhere and someone's learned some lines. But you know what I mean? Yeah. It's just more intelligent.
What do you think happened?
I think we've become very cynical. And I think that's what we now like to watch. We like to watch darker programs, and that captures our sense of there not being any great leaders that we admire. Yeah, it's just a reflection of us in the end.
And the modern world itself, what bugs her?
I don't like noise. I don't like a lot of noise. We are a very noisy society. Mm. I think you need a bit of silence to have a good think about things. So I don't like the constant noise wherever we go.
Oh, like the background music wherever we go.
Oh, yeah. You know, I can wait on a phone. I don't need music. It's fine.
Yes, like, that's right.
Rather than that droning sound in my ear for 40 minutes while I'm on the phone waiting for Telstra to, you know, pick up a phone, a little bit of silence is fine.
Yeah. I've been asking people to turn the music down at restaurants way before I became an old deaf man. You know, like, please, off.
Well, there's just a time and place, right? Yeah. If you're going to a gig, you want loud music.
That's why I'm there.
Right? Saturday night, I've got people here. I want you know, Fleetwood Mac blaring. Mm. But sometimes quiet is good. People don't always need to speak, which is a funny thing to be saying on a podcast. We couldn't literally sit here and say nothing. But, you know, I think a lot of people have this sense that you have to fill every void with words. And as someone who has to watch a lot of politics, it's really unfortunate because they're not terribly good at, you know, stringing words together. But, yeah, the pause is important. Silence is even better. Oh, you're pausing. It took me a while. Sorry, I'm so unused to it.
We broadcasters know how to pause. Our final topic I introduced with one word.
Dogs. Dogs. Well, I threatened my editor recently because I've been writing fairly, you know, heavyweight, intense stuff in the last 6 months. I threatened that I would write a column about a dog. Because Charles Krauthammer once wrote about a dog, and he's a writer that I admired for many years. And I think it was one of his most popular columns ever. He wrote about a dog that died. And we had a dog recently that died, a 2-year-old golden retriever. Hmm. So I threatened my editor that I would probably soon write a column about a dog because it is incredible. I've just been reminded how a dog forms part of your family and just becomes so important. So the grieving when you lose a dog is enormous. And I've decided that I don't now, you know, break the world up into, you know, people who believe this or people who believe that. I now divide the world up into people who love dogs and people who don't like or understand dogs. That's my new division of the world.
I believe, and this is based on the interviews I've done so far, that these are totally engaging conversations. Ask someone what they believe, they really have to think about what they're going to say. And that makes for a great podcast. I hope you're enjoying this series so much you're telling everyone about it and you've already subscribed to it on the Listen app or wheresoever you find your pods. Headroom, the Belief series, is produced and written by me with Chloe McKenzie and Grant Walter. Original music, Roy Valentine.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.
Hi, it's Waleed Ali here. No doubt you really enjoyed that edition of Headroom. If you did, can I invite you over to listen to a show that I do with Scott Stevens called The Minefield? Because, of course, if Headroom's about talking to people about beliefs and principles and core driving values, then The Minefield is kind of like discussing those without the people. Wouldn't you say, Scott?
I think that's right. I guess the other thing, though, is that Headroom sounds kind of safe. It sounds secure. It sounds like a nice, capacious environment in which you can sit down, relax, put up your feet and listen to a fascinating conversation. The Minefield is just a lot more confusing and dangerous. Am I underselling this? Am I overselling this? I mean, I think it's a lot of fun, but there's not safety involved.
If you like the safety of listening to a show but being able to say your edgy at the same time, The Minefield, it's for you.
And you can find it on the ABC Listen app.